Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. A report just released this week brings good news for renewable energy. The U.S. solar industry has apparently had a record year of growth in 2015 already, and solar panels across the country are producing 20 billion watts of power. In fact, 40% of all new electricity installations in the first half of the year were solar installations. The Washington Post explained that the growth boom is being fueled by a combination of declining costs, low interest rates, and a federal solar investment tax credit. In late August, President Obama visited Las Vegas, which is being referred to as ground zero for the solar boom, and addressed the National Clean Energy Summit. The Energy Department also announced $1 billion in federal loan guarantees for solar projects. Well, overall, it's a good time for solar in the U.S., and even though we're far behind Europe and even China, the future looks bright, pun intended. My guest is Philip Warburg. He's the author of Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. He's past president of the Conservation Law Foundation in New England, and his earlier book was entitled Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. Welcome to Uprising, Philip. Thanks for joining us. Now, are you surprised by the boom in solar that the U.S. is experiencing? After all, you wrote about wind energy before you wrote about solar.
Yes, when I actually was writing my book about wind energy, people asked me if my next book might be about solar. This was back in 2011 and 2012. And at the time, my kind of flip response was, if I wrote a book about solar power, I'd have to call it Dim Sun. Because at that point, it really seemed like solar, dim sun, that it seemed like solar was at the margins. I was happily mistaken and discovered that era and decided to set out on a journey across America to look at the prospects for solar energy as it has been developing. And as you rightly stated, the statistics for the first half of this year are pretty phenomenal. And I should just add to them that if you add wind power during the first half of this year to solar, you get to 75% of our total new installed capacity during the first 6 months of this year from renewable energy. So that's a pretty remarkable step toward a more sustainable energy future.
So 40% of all installations solar, but 75% of renewable, because that includes solar and wind.
Correct.
These are new energy installations. So this is the sort of growth part of the energy industry in general.
That's correct.
How did your own experience of installing solar on your home's roof become part of your journey of seeing that solar is so promising?
Well, when we started looking at the economics, we realized that we would very likely get a full return on our investment within 5 to 7 years. This was 2 years ago when we installed our solar system. Turns out we get about 75% of our total household power needs from our solar array, and that includes the daily charging of a plug-in electric vehicle. It's a Ford C-Max, which I'm happy to say is a great departure for the American automotive industry, in that they're really producing some smart vehicles today that actually take advantage of the electric car technology that is very quickly evolving.
So there is residential rooftop, which is, I'm assuming, what you did. And then and that's basically, it applies for homeowners as well as homeowners who have a little bit of money to invest in installing solar panels, even if they went out to lease them. Often a down payment is required. But there's also slowly some shared community solar projects. But what if we want large-scale solar? Because if we want to power cities, don't we need to rely on giant solar fields?
I think if we want to really talk about a fundamental transformation in our power supply, we have to adopt our version of President Obama's all-of-the-above energy policy and apply it to renewable, and specifically apply it to solar. So that means that we develop solar power on our rooftops. It's been estimated that we could get about a fifth of our total power supply if we tap all of the rooftop capability in this country. It means we also should be looking at warehouse roofs, factory roofs, big box stores, and the like. It means we should be looking at brownfields, as in contaminated or potentially contaminated industrial properties like abandoned coal mines or landfills. The EPA has done a study of those and has estimated that if we tap all of the solar potential on America's brownfield, we could be getting about 7 times America's total household electricity needs.
Wow.
And it also means that we should be looking at greenfield solar, that is to say, solar on farmland and very carefully done solar on natural open spaces. And a fair amount of that is being done in California today.
So you said very carefully, because of course, often we hear that there are major environmental concerns around large solar fields, whether these are from people who are sincere in seeing a solar future for the U.S. or simply, throwing up obstacles is a question. But what about that environmental question? Because it is important.
That's right. We can't ride roughshod over natural resources and wildlife issues. And the California Valley Solar Ranch, which is on the Carrizo Plain, a little bit north of you, is a great example of a solar development that has taken great pains to protect wildlife on a 1,400-acre site. That's how much acreage the actual solar arrays take up. They very carefully relocated the San Joaquin kitfox that were in the area, did the same for the giant kangaroo rat. And they've just set an exemplary, I think, model for how you can protect the environment and develop solar on a very large scale. I should add that they also arranged for the set aside of about 12,000 acres for permanent conservation. So those are great examples of where smart and sensitive solar developers can develop solar technology on a utility scale. That particular project provides enough electricity for 100,000 California households.
Now, I understand solar is so popular now that even sports arenas and stadiums are looking into it.
That's true. The National Football League, for example, has installed solar power on 6 of its stadiums. I think 5 are complete and a 6th is underway. One of the challenges there, I spoke with people from NRG Energy who are installing these systems, and they were trying to figure out the safe way to install solar canopies in parking areas at one of the NFL stadiums, this one in Philadelphia. And what they had to calculate was the arc of a football when it is being thrown by people who are waiting for the football game to begin in the parking lot. They wanted to make sure that the solar arrays were higher than the arc of the typical football thrown by a fan.
And so those massive floodlights that light up nighttime games could be, and maybe are in some stadiums, actually being powered by the sun?
Yes, they are. Again, solar energy is generated when the sun is out. So what happens is the electricity is produced, is fed into the grid, and there's a net calculation as to energy produced and energy consumed. And these stadiums come out ahead, often in terms of the actual energy consumed relative to what is produced at the array.
Now, there's also colleges and universities that are exploring this as well, right? And how important is that for college campuses to start going solar?
I think it's very important. There's a very active and flourishing divest of fossil fuels movement on many, many college and university campuses. And I think there has to be a very potent counterpoint to that, which is, okay, divest of fossil fuels, invest in sustainable energy technology. So if you look at a campus like Arizona State University in Tempe, they have 86 different solar arrays installed in their system. And this is a campus, it's largely a commuter campus, 60,000 students, and they get about 30% of their peak solar, when the sun is producing at its maximum, they're getting about 30% of their total power needs on that campus, which is really quite impressive. But it doesn't just have to be in areas like Arizona, where we know there's lots of sun. At Rutgers University in New Jersey, there are solar arrays at their Livingston campus that also generate a very substantial portion of the power needs of that campus. So I think we can really see solar be rolled out across the country on university campuses.
Now, the solar boom seems to be uneven geographically within the United States, with California way ahead of all other states in how much solar energy is produced. Why is California so far ahead? And what could the rest of the country learn from how California has done solar?
Well, I think California is exemplary. It's got a lot of the right policies in place, starting with a renewable portfolio standard that currently is at 33% of all electricity needs to come from qualifying renewable sources by 2020. Your legislature is now debating raising that standard to 50% by 2030, which would be a great leap. And that gives a very powerful incentive to utilities to come up with the right ways to find those renewable sources of power. California has also been very good in providing incentives to homeowners and businesses for renewable energy, and it has a very good net metering policy, which means that homeowners and businesses can generate electricity when the sun is out and sell their surplus electricity to their local utility at a full retail rate, which is a very important aspect of developing solar power. So I think that's part of it. But one thing I want to stress, because I'm from chilly and snowy Massachusetts, is that solar photovoltaics actually work better in colder weather.
Really?
And yes, they do. Because they're drawing upon the sun's light and not upon the sun's heat.
And of course, electronics work better when they're cold, not when they're hot.
Precisely. So we enjoy actually a fairly sunny climate here in Massachusetts, even though it's very cold. Massachusetts now ranks number 6 in the nation in installed solar capacity, even though we're a small state. So we shouldn't just think, well, California is a highly solarized state. It's a huge state with lots of land. Massachusetts is constrained in its land resources, but we do have solar energy that we can tap in abundance.
And so cold, sunny days are good days for solar, but then there's geographic inconsistencies around the world as well. A relatively gray Germany is the leader in the world on how it does solar. Tell us how Germany, which has far fewer sunny days than the U.S., has gone so far ahead. Is it because they started investing in solar infrastructure much earlier than the U.S.? So what are the lessons we can learn from them?
Germany was really a pioneer in getting solar going with what was called the 100,000 roofs program back in the late 1990s. And what they have done, which is terrific, is they've made it as easy as possible for homeowners and businesses to install solar. One of the things that we've found is the cost, the hard costs of solar energy have come down very dramatically over the past few years. And by the hard costs, I mean the solar panels, the solar inverters, and the like. What's harder to bring down are the soft costs, the costs involved in getting a facility permitted and installing it in as efficient a manner as possible. And what we're finding is that Germany today, the soft costs are about 10% of the soft costs here in America. So that's one area where we can really learn from the German experience and make our installations and our permitting processes more efficient and get more solar built more quickly.
Now, here in the U.S., President Obama has been criticized by Republicans for subsidizing solar, and some naysayers have warned against a solar energy economic bubble created by the government subsidies that they worry will burst next year when the subsidies expire. Also, of course, after Obama's presidential tenure, any future president could simply change the way the U.S. supports solar.
I think one of the real problems in the way we have regarded energy policy in America for the past century is we have provided superabundant subsidies to the oil and gas industries. We've provided great safeguards in terms of insurance liability to the nuclear industry, as well as an enormous amount invested in research and development in that area. And for unfortunate reasons, primarily because the fossil fuel industry is really trying to fight solar tooth and nail, we're having to struggle to keep some level of continuity for the incentives that are now in place for solar power. The federal investment tax credit has been an enormous boon to the solar industry. It's been an appropriate catalyst to a nascent industry. And the fossil fuel industry has been fighting it tooth and nail. It will expire for residential installation entirely at the end of 2016. And for commercial and utility scale solar power, it will be reduced from 30% to a 10% tax credit. That's a big hit. And I think we really need to push hard to create a greater level of continuity. That continuity, by the way, is not just for the sake of the people who are installing the solar power. If you want to build a vibrant manufacturing base, you need some guarantee that you're going to have a vibrant industry over 10, 15, 20 years. You can't be basing your planning year to year on subsidies that are subject to the whim of Congress. So I think we really need to develop a longer range, more strategic perspective about the policies that support solar energy in our country.
So there is a solar boom. It's a great time for solar. But unless those reasons why solar has boomed unless they're preserved, it could start trending downward, which, of course, makes the political leadership all the more important. Any last thoughts, Philip, on any skepticism that you might face on this solar future of the United States?
Well, I think we're at the beginning of a very profound transformation, a move from an era where people really didn't think about where the electricity that they were consuming was coming from, to an era where we can really take charge of a lot of the electricity that we're producing and develop a much more sophisticated knowledge of that that technology. Along with that comes certain responsibilities and a level of complexity. Because solar is a variable resource, we need to develop the policy tools to accompany that resource. We need better storage. We need smarter use of our electricity in terms of when we use it, how we use it. And we're moving in that direction, but we're really just at the beginning stages of a solar energy era, and we need to nurture that industry going forward.
Well, Philip, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Is there a website you'd like to give out?
My website is Philip Warburg, that's one word, philipwarburg.com.
And we'll post that to uprisingwithsonali.com later today. Again, philipwarburg.com, WARBURG. Thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck to you with the book.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My guest is Philip Warburg. He is the author of Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. He is also a past president of the Conservation Law Foundation in New England, and his earlier book was entitled Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability.